This episode is brought to you by Ticker. Ticker.com is focused on bringing institutional-level investment research to you, the individual investor. Ticker.com is powered by S&P Global Capital IQ and has coverage of over 50,000 stocks globally with financial data, estimates, valuation metrics, ownership percentages, transcript filings, news, and more. Value Hive listeners can join Ticker's free beta trial today at ticker.com/hive. That's TIKR.com/hive.
One. All right, Michael Batnick, huge pleasure to have you on the show. You're kind of one of those people where when I sent out the Twitter DM, I was like, you know, this is going to fall under that category of like when I asked Manish Pabrai and all these other people with like hundreds of thousands of followers, I'm like, they're just going to say no or just not respond. But here we are doing this, and I just can't thank you enough for coming on the show.
My pleasure.
Let's dive right into something that's not investing related at all, but maybe it is. What are some of the best movies that you think people haven't seen?
I mean, this is impossible, because if there's a movie that you love and you talk to a friend and you find out they haven't seen it, you're like blown away, right? So I have no idea what people haven't seen. I mean, like, for example, have you seen Pulp Fiction? Like, I assume you have, but okay. Yes. Like Reservoir Dogs?
No.
Okay, come on.
I've seen Boondock Saints.
Okay, there you go. So I actually did a list of this a few weeks ago. And this is, it, like I said, it was actually kind of tough to come up with this because it's hard to generalize. But like I'll just pick two movies from that list that I really like that are very, very different. And I really hate to recommend a Mel Gibson movie, given the type of human being that he is. But have you ever seen Apocalypto?
No.
All right, watch that like tonight. So it's basically a 2-hour chase through the jungle. I don't know if it's the Aztecs or the Mayans, but that was a gripping movie. And another one that's very different is The Squid and the Whale with Jeff Daniels, Laura Linney, and Jesse Eisenberg. It's about a couple in the 80s in Brooklyn who get divorced, and the kids are, I don't know, 7 and 10 or maybe 10 and 13. And it's a funny and emotional, and that's a good movie.
All right, sweet. So Apocalypto, I haven't seen. Squid and the Whale didn't even know existed. I've heard of Apocalypto.
Noah Baumbach, the guy that did Marriage Story, that was a popular movie earlier this year. This was one of his first movies.
Got it. Yeah, no, I just finished Tenet, and I finished it for the second time. So I watched it last night for the second time, and
subtitles the second time.
Yes, 100%. I don't know.
Was it better the second time?
Yeah, I thought so. But then again, it's like I watched it the first time, and then a couple days later, scrolling through Twitter, saw Chamath gave it a pretty significant thumbs down. And so I was like, well, I got to watch it again now. And watch it again, and I thought it was way better, because there's things that you pick up in the second time where you're like, oh my gosh, it's almost like that, you know, basically that gif where DiCaprio is watching that movie and he's like, oh, there it is. It's like, that's what it's like. But it is crazy how for those that haven't seen, I'm not spoiling it, but the audio sound of the people talking is super low compared to everything else in the movie.
Isn't that so obnoxious? Fix the audio. Yeah. I love Christopher Nolan movies. Like truly, I think a lot of people do. But right now, I just don't have like the mental bandwidth to watch a movie that I know I'm going to have to watch twice. Like, come on. There's so many good movies that I still haven't seen. I never saw Apocalypto. I'm not Apocalypto. Apocalypse Now, for example.
Yeah.
Like, there's just too many good things to get to. So I don't know that I can waste my time on a movie that I have to watch a second time with subtitles.
Yeah. So. And it was one of those where it was like late at night too. And I was sitting there watching it, and during a quiet part, I would turn it way up while they were talking. And then it would cut to a scene, and it's like, you know, your classic Christopher Nolan, like, whoa, whoa, like heavy bass, just sort of shaking the house.
I mean, I'll definitely get to it, but I think I'm going to wait a while.
It's good. I like it. But in terms of financial movies, one of the things that I've been roasted on in the past is my lack of financial movie knowledge. I've seen The Big Short, and I've seen Wolf of Wall Street, and that's it.
Okay. I don't think there's that deep a well of financial movies. In terms of what are the best, I think there's two, and then there's everything else. There's Wall Street and Trading Places, and then everything else. I think there's some good ones that sort of went under the radar. Rogue Trader with Ewan McGregor. about the guy that took down Barings Bank. What's his name? Right. I'm drawing a blank on that.
He's on Twitter. I just saw that. There was some guy that tweeted about him.
No shit. I think he started a trading service. Is it Nick something? I forget. Anyway.
That's going to bug me.
That was a good one. You ever see Margin Call?
No.
Jeremy Irons plays like the boss. He kind of the Dick Fult character. It's basically, it's the GFC. It's what happened there. That was a really good one. Okay. Other than that, there's not a ton.
It's Nick Leeson.
Nick Leeson, that's right.
Yep, and he's on Twitter now. So it's at the Nick Leeson.
But I think he has a trading service.
That'd be hilarious. Yeah, he keynote business speaker, former Barings trader, nickleeson.com. Huh. Awesome. All right, sweet. So those two movies.
But come on, man. Wall Street and Trading Places?
Haven't seen them.
Do it.
Nope. All right. That's another.
I hate to be a movie shamer because it's like nobody likes to be given homework. But seriously, this is your homework. Watch those two movies.
I got it. I got a long Christmas weekend. So, I mean, best way to do it. Now,
Trading Places can double as a Christmas movie.
Yeah, that's a good point. All right, cool. I'll get everybody to watch that one. Now, if you could make a movie about 2020, who would play Michael Batnick?
If we're going strictly on looks, probably Channing Tatum.
Really? I was thinking more Bruce Willis.
Super Mugatu roasted me, I think, last year. It was a spitting image. Jesse Eisenberg as... what's the villain in Superman? I'm drawing a blank on his name, but Jesse Eisenberg was bald in Superman. So I guess that's who I would choose.
All right. Let's see what that, let's see. Oh, wow. Yep. I can
not
see
bad,
it.
Right?
Not bad. Not bad at all. It's like a mix between him and Bruce Willis. I can see it. Wow. All right, cool. Sweet. So with that aside, let's dive into some of your most recent posts on your blog, Irrelevant Investor. And I think it's appropriate to talk about IPO mania and just, you know, whether it's SPAC IPOs or just regular general IPOs. These pricings have been off the wall. We've seen it with DoorDash. We've seen it with Airbnb. It was really funny watching, I think it's Brian Chesky's reaction to him figuring out what prices his IPO was. What are your thoughts on kind of just the general IPO market right now in relation to maybe what we've seen in 1999?
Yeah. So I'm like one level below a generalist here. So, you know, I'm certainly a noob whale in terms of IPOs and SPACs. So take everything with a giant grain of salt. Feel free to fact check me. Is this 1999? Was that your question?
Yeah. Or how does this compare?
All right. So in 1999, I was 14. So I can't speak to that in real time. From what I understand, it was a DoorDash every single day. Now, the market caps of these companies were much smaller. But listen to what the NASDAQ did from 95 to 99. 40% in 95, 23% in 96. So you probably have to think that like the bubble calls were getting started, right? Imagine Twitter was around 23% the year after a 40% year. Then in 97, it did another 22%, and things were getting really frothy. Then in 98, it did another 40%. And this is just, this can't end well, right? This is going to burst. And then in 1999, 86%. So now listen, just because this isn't 1999, which is, you know, arguably one of the biggest bubbles of all time, that doesn't mean that things are not getting a little frothy. I hesitate to use the word bubble because that means that there's going to be some sort of bursting and that there's no economic rationale for what's going on. And I think you could say that in certain cases. And I know that, you know, Tesla's the obvious example. We don't need to go too down that rabbit hole. But yeah, there's fraud. There's no doubt about it. Do I think that we're going to see like all of these unicorns burned and just nothing but a pile of rubble worth 10% of what they were in 2020? I don't think so. I think that in 1999, these companies were valued off of nothing but potential eyeballs, not even revenue. And I think that we've gotten to the point where these companies move so quickly. They have such a deep understanding of the customer acquisition and how to generate profits and margins and all those sort of things. So I think that again, there's excess and it feels way too easy right now. Like I mess around in some of these speculative names, Open Door, for example, which we'll talk about SPACs. I've owned that for a while. And I think it's silly. It's silliness. And I think like in general, it's you got to be careful drawing parallels that are too close. Like the analog charts are obviously, you know, total bullshit. But, oh, this reminds me of 99 or 1969 or 29 or whatever. Every time is different. But what's never different is that making money in the stock market should not be this easy, cannot be this easy.
Right.
That part of it in general, where you open up your account, you own, you know, CrowdStrike or the Trade Desk or whatever it is, and up, I'm up another 7%. That can't happen in perpetuity. So it doesn't mean that these companies need to crash, but they have to grow into their valuation. And that could take time. And so the businesses can significantly outperform the stock price for the next 5-10 years.
Hmm. Yeah, no, that's important. It's one of those things. And you mentioned Tesla, and you know, we're not going to go too in depth in this, but one of my buddies who I'm using is almost like a sentiment gauger, because he just started trading. I think it was March, April. I mean, literally, he was the product of everyone was at home. And he's like, hey, I've got some extra cash, like might as well start playing around in stocks. Pumped it all into Tesla. All of that he was doing. And yeah, and he texted, we've got a group chat. He texted, he said, hey, if I took, because he also bought a house, he said, if I took my down payment for my house and just put that into Tesla, yeah, I'd be a multimillionaire. I was like, well, yeah, obviously hindsight's 20/20, but it's like, I wonder how much damage this is going to cause for those people that enter the market now thinking that everything is this easy.
Oh, there's going to, people will blow up. But is that new to today? Is that Robinhood's fault? I mean, people are, you know, before technology existed, people were going on leverage and doing silly things with the markets, whether it's commodity markets or stock markets. You know, FOMO is ancient. So I think it's easier right now to get swept up in it, given how, you know, that it's basically a dating app at this point. That's the stuff that concerns me, is that you see somebody turning $10,000 into 50 and think that they're going to turn it into 200. Okay.
Yeah. We'll see. You said Robinhood or these trading apps are basically like dating apps. What do you mean by that?
It's just, you're swiping. It doesn't feel real. And when Robinhood has a confetti raining down on you, I mean, so I was on Robinhood and I had to get rid of it. I switched my account over because I was, and this is not a ton of money. So I'm having fun with the stocks, but I was checking it every 5 seconds. It just became a habit, and it's meaningless, but I was addicted and I'm thinking like, what am I doing? So I think that they're certainly culpable in terms of pushing people towards thinking the stock market is one giant casino where all you have to do is pull a lever, you get a party, and then, you know, you see your stock prices go up.
And it's funny you mentioned that you were checking it all the time, and it's almost as if Robinhood took what made Facebook and Instagram great about, you know, basically getting our monkey brains to check it all the time.
They hacked my brain. Totally.
Yeah, exactly. Because my buddy, that same guy that invested in Tesla, he sent a screenshot. Robinhood will send you, this is, I don't know if you got this, but Robinhood will send you the top stocks that you checked the most over the year.
I got that.
Yeah, he checked. Guess how much he checked Tesla in 2020?
10 times a
day. And remember, he started in like March, April. Tesla.
10 times a day?
No, it's actually a little bit less, but he guessed, he checked it 1,540 times in 2020. So it was like 8.5 times a day.
Yeah, dude, me too. I was probably more. For no reason. For no reason at all. And so I'll tell you the stocks that I own that are speculative that I don't, I have like, $2,000 or $3,000 on these stocks. So, yeah, you know, they can get cut in half and I'm fine. Airbnb, CrowdStrike, DraftKings, Opendoor, Peloton, Snowflake. And I was checking them all the time for no reason. They have zero impact on my life. I'm just having fun. And it just took over my brain. So I don't, you know, Robin, it's a business. And what the part of their business that actually does not bother me at all is the order flow. Like, there was a report from, I think, Massachusetts regulators stating that, and they say they don't do this practices anymore. You know, I don't know if that's true or not. We'll take them at their word. Mm-hmm. That this costs clients $34 million. In other words, even though the stocks were free, their execution was such that they collectively lost $34 million.
Right.
Listen, what's the average transaction size? $50, $100, even if it's $1,000. So you get $3 with the trade slippage. It's free, big, you know, that you gotta know that's the price that you're paying.
Yeah.
If you want best execution, go to Interactive Brokers or someplace else. So that part of it does not necessarily bother me. Mm-hmm. But it's the whole idea that if you're attacking Robinhood, then you're saying that investing is only for the rich, which is, they put out a statement, I'm paraphrasing, that's basically where it's there. And that's just nonsense. That Wall Street is taking these, saying that these younger investors are unserious. They are unserious. 68% of option accounts in Massachusetts were from people that had no experience. That's not investing. That's gambling, which is. That's fine. I love gambling. I do. I love it. But that's not investing.
Right. Right. No, it's so.
And so, so last point, I'm sorry. Last point on this.
No, go ahead.
I used to think that this was a good thing, that this is great, that people are going to get involved in the market. They're going to realize how difficult it is. And eventually they're going to either get bored or throw up their hands and say, I can't beat the market. I'm out.
Right.
And for certain people, that's certainly the case. But for other people, and I can't measure this, but if you're a young person, how your formative early experiences, how they mold you and how you see the market. And if your first experience in the market is that it's a giant slot machine, I don't know that can be undone.
Yeah. I mean, it almost goes back to this idea of when you had a generation that grew up in the Great Depression, and then you saw them all throughout their lives, whether it's hoarding tendencies or whether it's, you know, super risk averse. It's like you were born in a time where there was nothing, employment was 27, whatever percent it was. And that was then. But even now, when you've got record low unemployment, when you've got an economy that's stronger than ever, you know, barring, you know, before COVID or whatever, and they're still they still cling to those habits. And we don't know what the magnitude of that is because that cycle's so long.
Yeah. And I mean, I think I do genuinely think it's awesome that people can get involved in the market, can learn, can play, can have fun. Obviously some people are going to take it too far. But I don't think that, I don't think that this is going away. I don't think it's a fad. Like, unless this is a .com like bubble where all of these names, the, you know, the ones that I just mentioned that I'm invested in, the Zooms, the DocuSigns, the Pelotons, whatever, if they all fall 90%, then yeah, maybe the Gen Zs and millennials, you know, younger millennials will be wiped out and will view investing differently. But I don't see that happening. So I don't think that this is a fad. I think it's here to stay. And even if these names do get burned, then they'll move on to whatever's working. That's fine.
Yeah. Did you read Packy McCormick's post? I think it was Software's Eating the Markets. Have you read that?
I read everything he writes. He's amazing.
Yeah, no, he's incredible. And he had this idea, which I'm sure, you know, you agree with as well, is that stocks aren't ownerships in businesses, they're ownerships in brands and identities.
And there are non-financial reasons for why people are behaving the way they are.
Yeah.
And in fact, the financial gains are almost besides the point.
Yep.
It's fun, it's identity, it's belonging, it's all of those other sort of non-quantifiable things, which I hear myself, you know, that sounds very toppy, whatever, but that's a huge part of it.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, going back to Tesla, it's, you know, I asked my friend, I said, why do you own Tesla? He's like, because Elon Musk is going to change the world and I want to be a part of that. Like none of that conversation was about valuation, was about number of cars sold, any of that. It was like, because he's going to change the world and I want to be known as one of the people that helped him do it.
Yeah. I get it.
Yeah, I get it too.
Especially if you're a young person and you haven't read all the market history and you're just unfamiliar, I don't blame these people. I don't think they're idiots. Like I genuinely understand what's going on. I would, if I was 23 years old and I was just starting, I would be right there with them. No doubt about it.
Tell you what things I don't understand though are SPACs and just this craze that we've seen with whether it's electric vehicles or just anything with a SPAC has just, you know, at IPOs at $10 go straight through the roof, especially if Chamath does it, he's going IPO A through Z.
Yeah.
And it's frustrating because I was trying to look at SPACs like a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, and it was just what everybody said they were, flaming piles of garbage.
Yeah.
And now everybody loves SPACs and I'm frustrated because it's like, I wish I would have found these good ones while the hunting was, while there were no hunters in the field.
Yeah.
But do you think that what we're seeing in the SPAC market is maybe more similar to what we experienced in 1999
yes.
with everything going crazy?
Yes, I do. So in 2016, there was 15 SPACs. So far this year, according to SPAC Insider, 243. They raised over $81 billion. And Carl Quintanilla tweeted, this is from Goldman, $61 billion in SPAC IPO proceeds is currently searching for acquisition targets. Based on their 24-month post-IPO expiration date, these SPACs will need to acquire a target in 2021 or 22, nearly equal to the total enterprise value of SPAC deal closures during the last decade. And you know that these companies are finding a home. You know that there's going to be mergers. Yeah. There's no way that this money is going back to investors. So there are going to be some horrific, total piles of dog shit deals coming out. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah. And what's frustrating, though, is you've got that truth, which I believe, but you also have a private market where companies are staying private longer, and those tend to be actually good businesses. So like you've got a lot of good, maybe they're not technology businesses, but they're service businesses, you know, they're pool operators, they're your kind of Brent B. Shore, you know, boring businesses that actually do generate cash flow. And so my question is, with all this money pumping into SPACs, why is everybody seeming to go to the same pond where it looks like there's a bunch of private businesses out there that could be taken public?
What do you mean exactly?
Like, it seems like everybody's rushing in to get these like EV scooters or, you know, this like hydroponic farm stuff when there's actually legitimate businesses that in the private markets, people are having a hard time changing hands, where you've got a mom and pop that's run, you know, say like a landscaping service business that does 4 to 5 million in EBITDA. They've got commercial contracts. It's like, okay, why can't you find those types of businesses, bring those to market?
SPACs are story vehicles. Yep. You're selling an idea, and who the fuck wants to buy a steady business? Who, like, that's not exciting. I don't care. Oh, they're doing $400 million a year and they're growing at 7%. That's great. But this company is doing $0 in revenue and they're going to grow 3,000% and they're going to change the world. Which one do you want?
It's a good question. I want the one that'll actually deliver me the cash flows eventually.
I want the one that's going to pop 40% on day one.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, then it goes back to just kind of the different timeframes that people play in too. Cause then we could go back to Robinhood being this vehicle where now people's timeframes are shortened even more, from months to days to weeks.
So I think that there's certainly some positives to the SPACs. Like for the example that people can, and it sounds insane that you're going to give somebody money before you actually know what they're going to buy.
Yeah.
The flip side to that is if it's a, you have the opportunity to buy before the pop. And obviously, unlike Airbnb and DoorDash, you're buying after 100% move. So that's the positives. We know the downsides. I mean, I was reading about this from CB Insights, and they were talking about how institutional investors have the opportunity to pass on the merger once it's announced.
Right.
And also they get warrants. So they could sort of double down if the going is good. Retail investors don't get any of that. So this is highly favorable to institutional investors. Obviously, it's highly favorable to the sponsor who's getting the founder shares. And I feel like that doesn't really make sense to me. Now, why are these companies agreeing to go through the SPAC process? Why not just go the traditional IPO route? Well, a few reasons. One is certainty. Right. So there's no guessing. Like the IPO, the way that the IPO market works today, I'm not an expert, but it does sound sort of bonkers. Like,
yeah,
DoorDash surprised me a lot because it seems like everybody's on the same side of the boat, that this is a garbage business model. It's not even a viable business model. And what were they worth on day one? $60 billion. And there was, something massive there. And there was tremendous demand. So that surprised me. But then what surprised me even more the next day was like, everyone seemed to want a piece of Airbnb, right? Everybody was agreeing that, you know, the fact that they're worth more than all the other hotel competitors in the United States, maybe that makes sense. Yeah. But how did that miss the mark so badly? How did that pop 100%? Like how? How did the bankers not do a better job? So if I'm Brian Chesky and some of the VCs, I understand why they've got some gripes there. I really do. Like how has it not gotten a little bit more efficient? And then on the company side, you have the certainty when you're doing a SPAC. Mm-hmm. It's much quicker. Whether or not it's more financially efficient, I don't know all the details. It sounds like it's probably not. But I think that what was announced yesterday on the direct listing side was a significant development.
It's actually funny you mentioned that. On the other side of my screen, I've got Bill Gurley's tweet about what they did. So if you want to go in here and talk about that, I can kind of pinball what Gurley's thoughts were as well.
All right. So this is from the journal yesterday. Until now, companies have only been allowed to use direct listings to sell existing shares, which means their founders and early investors could cash out of their stakes, but the company couldn't raise new capital. So that's how it used to work. Mm-hmm. Ostensibly, companies go public to raise money, right? Because they need the capital. And now they could actually do that with a direct listing. So if I'm Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, that's a significant part of their business model. I think that this is again, knowing very little here and being a sub-generalist, I think that from what I understand, this is a good thing.
Yeah, and I'm actually just going to pick up what Bill Gurley tweeted yesterday at, you know, around lunchtime. He said, a wonderful 2020 Christmas present to the founders, employees, and investors at VC-backed startups. SEC just approved the ability to add primary capital, i.e. fundraise, to a direct listing. It's a very exciting way to see the SEC enable innovation. And he went on, and the next part, which is important, he said, this is huge and will hopefully end 40 years of mispriced IPOs through an old, antiquated process that failed to match supply and demand and wasn't open to all investors. In 2018, there was $6 billion in underpricing, which means, you know, basically you can say the $6 billion in underpricing is the investment banker's profit at that point. It's their margin. And then go ahead.
Well, I think that's a little bit of bullshit, and here's why. It's not as if that money was left on the table, because those were small buyers that are coming in, right? So if you were to try and raise money from a handful of buyers at that valuation, they're going to balk. They're not going to say yes. So is it, you said it was $6 billion?
It was $6 billion in 2018. Then it moved to $7 billion in underpricing in 2019.
But let's say it's half of that. That's still a big number.
Yeah.
Right? So let's say that the IPO on Airbnb was, you know, at a $60 billion valuation. And then 24 hours later, nope, it's 100. Okay, that's a huge gap. So could they have gotten 70 or 80? Probably. But could they have gotten 90 or 100 from the big institutional investors? No, I don't think they could have.
Yeah. And then Gurley notes, in 2020, they set a new record, smashed 2019, $34 billion in one-day gains for iBank customers with allocation. I.e. underpricing.
Well, it's hard to, that's a hard pill to swallow. It's also, I don't necessarily feel like the VCs are the victims here or the founders, right? I mean, it's hard to feel too bad for them. But that being said, I think that the system, you know, from an outsider's point of view, does not make sense today, given where technology is, that the pricing could be so far off. And I find it hard to believe that this direct listing in terms of raising capital didn't exist before yesterday. I mean, what took so long?
Yeah, no, it's kind of crazy. Now, do you think SPACs are going to become, like, let's say 5 to 10 years from now, do you think SPACs will be a more normal way of going public for any business?
I don't know why you would choose a SPAC over a direct listing. Is it maybe you could come public quicker? But so what? How much quicker? So again, just not knowing all the details, I would be curious to hear somebody who actually knows why they would prefer a SPAC over a direct listing. But I do think that I think that from what I understand, the SPACs are a more viable way of going public today than they were, say, 10 or 15 years ago, when it was really, you know, piles of shit that did that.
Yeah, there's the one thing I do know, whether or not any of these SPACs actually make it, is there's going to be some interesting short arbitrage opportunities here coming up with what's going to go public.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very excited to watch how this progresses.
So then my last question for you about SPACs, since you also like sports, I'm thinking I'm trying to combine sports and investing here. You're also, you like to gamble, like to speculate. Over under, we'll call it, you know, 45, 50. Will Chamath produce more SPACs, 40 or 50, than James Harden will visit strip clubs?
I don't think Chamath is going to get to 40. I do. Is he even going to fill out the alphabet? Do you think he'll do that? I mean, that's pretty ambitious.
He said he would, and I feel like the ego, not in the sense of, you know, I'm not saying he's got a huge ego, but I feel like once you say something like that in public, there is an onus for you to, I guess, deliver.
So he's already delivered three. He's filed another three. I think he's all the way to F now, and then he's got them all the way out to Z. So I guess one of the things that we didn't mention, speaking of Chamath, is like, maybe if you're a company that wants to go public, you could view Chamath as a strategic partner. I don't know if that's, you know, real or not. I guess, you know, it depends on who the partner is. I'm sure Ackman thinks that he's going to bring some expertise to the table. Maybe he will, maybe he won't. Yeah. So maybe that's another reason for why companies would choose to go the SPAC route rather than direct listing or traditional IPO.
Yeah. And it's also interesting too, like for these, you know, they're not brokerages obviously, but these investment firms, whether it's Social Capital or Ackman at Pershing, is if you can become kind of like the go-to person for the SPACs to go public, you can create a pretty interesting business there where you're now just, okay, you want to go to SPAC? All right, go to Pershing, or all right, go to Social Capital. And then you become almost like the verb for SPACs. It's like, oh, just go through Pershing.
To Ackman's credit, he's not taking the founder shares and he's putting up a ton of money. So,
which is what I think you should do anyway.
Credit where credit is due on that one.
Yeah. Yeah. What a year for Ackman. Wow.
Yeah.
All right. Let's move on now to when to sell, because I think this is a great topic as markets churn through all-time highs. Obviously, that's what people want to know. Like, hey, when should I sell? When's the right time to sell? And your article on this, which I'll link to in the show notes, is great. And you know, you basically say, you know, selling's inherently more difficult than buying. And I'm going to give you a quote and I'll let you run from there. The quote from the article is, selling is more difficult than buying for a few reasons. You're thinking clearly before you buy something. Once you pull the trigger, it's yours. It's no longer Amazon. It's my Amazon. You're now anchored to that purchase price and your profit or loss influences your decisions.
Have you found that to be true?
Yes.
I think anybody who says no would be lying. But the problem is your purchase price is not relevant in determining how much a share is worth, whether it's going higher or lower, whether the business is improving or deteriorating. And I pulled a quote from one of my favorite books. You ever read The Money Game by Adam Smith?
No.
All right. I cannot recommend it highly enough. Again, not to give homework, but it's a short one. I think it's from like the 60s and it could have been written today. Okay. Some things are dated, but you know, human nature never changes, as you know. He wrote, a stock is for all practical purposes a piece of paper that sits in a bank vault. Obviously, that's no longer true. Most likely, you will never see it. It may or not have an intrinsic value. What it is worth on any given day depends on the confluence of buyers and sellers that day. Mm. The most important thing to realize is simplistic. The stock doesn't know you own it. All those marvelous things or those terrible things that you feel about a stock or a list of stocks or an amount of money represented by a list of stocks, all of these things are unreciprocated by the stock or the group of stocks. You can be in love if you want to, but that piece of paper doesn't love you. And unreciprocated love can turn into masochism, narcissism, or even worse, market losses and unreciprocated hate. And so I guess the question is, all right, great. That's a great quote, but what do I do with that? I don't have any great answers. You know, I've thought a lot about this. I wish I did. But you can't tell somebody to be less human, right? You can't tell somebody, don't ignore your purchase price. That's not realistic. What I think is realistic, one way to minimize the influence that price has over your senses is to position size in a way that you don't get too high or low emotionally. And that's mm-hmm. That's different for everybody. For some people that might be, you know, 5%. For some people that might be 10 or 15. And the only way to know your sweet spot is to just try and you'll come to the right number. And I don't think that there is a substitute. I don't think that you could find this answer in a book. I don't think there's any, you know, when to sell. I mean, my goodness, tell me what the future is and then I'll tell you when to sell. So I think you just got to come up with a process. It doesn't have to be optimal or scientific, or it just has to be reasonable. And I think that's the best that we can do.
Do you think investors, specifically, you know, value type investors, the buy and hold, they get in trouble with this because, and I don't know if I'm going to say this right, but there's almost an element where it's not that you have to attach yourself to an investment, but you have to take the position that, hey, I'm invested in this business. I am part owner. There is that notion that goes along with that. And I think investors get trapped sometimes in that framework where it's like, you know, if I'm a part owner, why would I sell this? Because Warren Buffett said, if you're a good private buyer, you only buy 5 or 6 and you don't sell. I think that can get people in danger if they don't position right. So you can have like a 5%, 3 to 5% position, sleep at night. If it goes to 0, that's fine. But I think you get a little bit in muddy water when you start getting bigger positions with that value mindset.
It's not just a financial investment that you're making. It's a personal investment. Your time, your ego. And for people like you and for people that make a living picking stocks and it's their passion, you're not going to not talk about your stocks, right? That's what we do here. You talk about your positions, your research, your process, your price targets, your, you know, whatever, whatever. But that's dangerous, because the more you talk about a position, the more you defend it in public, the more that, you know, the tighter the tentacles are on your grip on that position. And there was a, you ever see the documentary on Bill Ackman on Netflix?
Yeah.
I forget what it was called, but he's talking about one of the presentations he's doing on Herbalife. I don't know if this was his second or third, you know, he did a bunch, and his publicist is like, well, what if the stock goes up when you're talking? He's like, it's not going to. And the publicist is basically like, what if it does, you know, help me out here. What if it does? And Bill Ackman's just like, no, it's not going to. And the stock fucking ripped as he's talking. And so when you're doing that sort of thing in public, I don't know how you reverse yourself. I really don't. So what type of superhuman being do you need to be able to do to say, all right, everything that I said the last 24 months, I was wrong. Sorry, I'm moving on to the next one. Like, yeah, it's really easy to give somebody that sort of advice to not be emotional, but I don't know how you do it. Do you?
No, I don't. And the documentary is called Betting on Zero, by the way.
Right.
Yeah. It's also funny, because then you've got the inverse of that too, where he was shorting, and, you know, not to pick on Bill Ackman, because I think he's an incredible investor.
He doesn't need our defense. He's okay.
No, he doesn't need our defense. He's fine. He's playing tennis in the Hamptons or something. Yeah. But you also flip that, and he was very, very public on his bet on Valiant. And he was getting even more public as it was going, you know, as it was falling.
Right.
And he was like, look, you know, things are fine. He rode that so far down. And I think that's the same type of mentality. You can't go back.
So this is sort of one of the problems I have with behavioral finance and all these quotes. And, you know, I like the quotes and I get it. But what do you do with them? Right? They're fortune cookies.
Yeah. You put them on your walls. Get them on Etsy.
Exactly. Losers average losers. If you put that behind your computer screen, you're automatically a good trader. I don't know if you know that. That's a free tip.
It adds 10 percentage points to your year-end P&L.
There you go.
No, but it is funny, because one of the things that we were talking about before we hit record was one of the ways that I stumbled upon MacroOps was I found that they were writing about not just investors, not just the Buffets and stuff, but the traders. And one of the things that I love about the traders and trading psychology and, you know, all of that is that Larry Hite, for example, I think he started Mint Investments, one of the most successful, you know, investment funds. I think he was the pioneer of like the managed futures trend following system or something. And he had a line in a podcast. He said, look, everything to me is just a 1% bet. And I just read that and I was like, that's amazing. Like, that is totally freeing, where it's like he can go long in silver, let's say, risk 1%, use risk management. And if he loses, all right, cool. He can do that 99 more times. And if he loses 99 times in a row, then maybe he deserves to lose all his capital. But I just love the freedom that brings, where it's like I can invest. And if I've got risk management or something, and you say, you know what, I'm wrong, I can always get back in. I'm wrong. It's just another bet.
Well, that's the thing. When you're taking position sizes like that, it is freeing. You could do whatever you want. You know, on to the next. You have 99 other positions. And I think that if young people make one mistake repeatedly, and there's a lot of them, and I made them all, is that you trade with a size that's too big for your comfort zone.
Yep.
And I'm sure you've read the Market Wizards books.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there are 10 million different ways to be a successful investor or trader. And obviously there's 10 billion ways to be an unsuccessful investor or trader. But I think the natural progression is most people start out with value investing, right? And you look at a few ratios and you're like, oh, when the stock is trading at 0.5 times sales, I'm going to buy it. And then, you know, you get burned a few times doing that. And then you probably move on to Jesse Livermore. You find him, you find the Market Wizards and Paul Tudor Joneses of the world. And, you try and either pick tops or bottoms, or you find trend following, and there's, you know, everything in between. And for some people like myself, I wasn't good at any of them. So I basically just said, you know what, this is a game I can't win. I think most people just don't have enough respect for how hard it is.
Yeah.
Right. Like you know, you're reading people, you're following people. forget about the Renaissances of the world, you know, and millenniums, just put them to the side, even though you can't. They're the great white sharks. But what sort of an idiot do you need to be to do this stuff as a side project and to see all the thought and effort and sweat and research and hours that go into it and think that you can compete? It's ridiculous. The problem is when you're buying and selling, you don't see who you're buying and selling from. Right. If you knew that you were buying, that Jim Simons was trading against you, you wouldn't play. But you don't see it.
That's a great point. Yeah.
So it's easy to be overconfident, but I kept a journal. And if I didn't, I probably would still be banging my head against the wall. But I was literally shorting Amazon in 2011. And I would read what I was writing in my theses, and it sounded ridiculous. It sounded absolutely ridiculous. And I was embarrassed to read what I wrote like 6 months ago. And I probably did that for 2 years. And I never, you know, I never blew up or anything. I mean, it was, how could you? Market was going higher. But I just realized that, like, I'm not cut out for this. I don't have the emotional, mental wherewithal. So I stopped playing.
Yeah. Yeah. That's another thing, is just the importance of putting your thoughts down on paper for any idea that you have, because you can always go back, like the pre-mortems, the post-mortems, and just seeing, you know, hopefully it's that development. Because I know, I mean, I've looked back at some of the theses I wrote a year ago, 6 months ago, and I'm like, that's so simple. Like, it's so stupid. Like, you forgot XYZ. You missed XYZ, ABC.
So years later, I did come back to the individual stock market. And what I do with my play account, and it's not, you know, it's real money, is I've got like grandpa stocks, like boring dividend yielding stocks. And then I've got like the Open Doors and Pelotons and Snows of the World. So I've got a barbelled approach on that end.
Yeah, which is something I really want to dive into more. You know, we probably don't have time for this podcast, but just getting these portfolio construction ideas thinking. It's, you know, you can have this, the way I like to think about it is almost like the way video game companies do it, is they just make a bunch of video games and then one of them's going to hit. And then that one's going to make up for all the loss, you know. So it's like small loss, boom, big loss. And it's like, I wonder if you can create something like that inside of a larger portfolio, where you've got your core holdings, then you've got these call option video game development type bets, where it's like, boom, you know, small 1%, half percent, make a few of those. If one of them, you know, hits, it's like a 5, 6, 7xer.
Yeah, you can do whatever you want. I mean, seriously, this is your blank canvas, and people can invest however the hell they want. And some people smell the roses and they discover that they're no good at it and they keep trying and it never gets better. And then, you know, they seek help and what, I mean, there's a million different ways to do it.
What are your thoughts on how to combat this short-term minded investment world where Twitter is, you know, every second you can get an idea or you can get a thought on a stock, versus the just benefits that come with long-term thinking? And the way I'm going to ask that question is, we've been in a bull market now, which, you know, who knows how long that can go, but it's easy to be a long-term thinker when your holdings go up every day.
Yep.
So eventually that's going to turn. I'm not, you know, this obviously isn't a podcast figuring out when that's going to turn, but it's
also hard to be a long-term thinker when things are growing up 7% every day.
Yeah, that's true.
Right. So, all right, finish your question.
Yeah. So my question is, like, since most people are probably going to get inebriated with, you know, oh, just hold, because look, every time I check my stocks every week, every month, like, you know, I'm in the green. Robinhood has no red function on their UI. This is amazing, but it's going to turn. And so what is your advice? Maybe what are some of your, you know, lessons that you've learned about how to retrain the mind to think about the long term?
Well, you have to define what you're trying to do. What are your objectives? Like, why are you having fun? And if you're gambling, then you should have, then long-term, who cares about long-term?
Right.
But if you're investing for a purpose, because you want to be able to live a certain lifestyle or potentially retire one day, then who cares what happens tomorrow or the next day or the next day? If you think that you're going to navigate the ups and downs in the markets consistently over the next 20 and 30 years, then you're out of your mind. You're just out of your mind. So what I do with my personal investing is I automate it. Every 2 weeks, I buy index funds in my 401k, and I have a taxable account where I'm buying index funds at our robo liftoff, which is powered by Betterment. And so that's what I'm doing for the long term. And I don't care where the market goes. I mean, obviously I don't want the market to get cut in half because, you know, our clients have a lot of money invested in the stock market. But if it does for me personally, that would not bother me. Because in fact, again, personally, selfishly, it would be a good thing for me. I have a long time. I would rather buy something at 50 than at 300.
Yeah.
So I'm unconcerned where the market goes over the next 2 to 5 years, because I'm not retiring until, you know, 20, 30 years. So I don't care.
Yeah.
But it's, I don't know if that was a great answer to the question. It's hard because you could do, I think generally speaking, there are two things that you can do. If you are trading and or investing, you can try to maximize returns. And the only way to do that, I think, is A, getting lucky and picking the right stocks. So Tesla had a 60% drawdown this year and it's up 640%. So again, I'm sorry to mention Tesla. Let's go to any other stock. Any of the biggest winners, Apple, Amazon, Microsoft, Netflix, whatever. They've all gotten killed along the way, multiple times, killed. Apple had a 45% loss in 2013, which was one of the best years in recent history for the stock market. So who do you think made more money in those names? The people that trading them or the people that bought and held them? Yeah, right? I mean,
buy and hold.
It's the buy and holds. There's no doubt about it. Now, on the other hand, I picked the outliers. For every Apple, there's 50 GoPros, right? So that's why I said you have to get a little bit lucky. The other side of things is you can employ risk management. And I don't think you can employ risk. Sorry to all the Seth Klarman fans. I don't think you can employ risk management using fundamental analysis. I don't think that the margin of safety exists anymore. Like,
why do you say that?
There's too many smart people. I don't think that those free lunches exist. The cigar butts died in the 50s. There's not pennies on the sidewalk anymore. There just aren't. So if you are concerned about buying the next General Electric and you are going to manage your downside risk, whether you're using a trailing stop or a moving average or a, you know, I'll risk 20% or whatever you're using, fine. I can get behind that. But if you're trying to cut off some of the downside, then you can't, by definition, get all of the upside, right? You can't have it both ways. So I think that there's neither one is right or wrong. You don't have to do one or the other, right? You can buy and hold some names and trade other names. Like, again, it's all just about figuring out whatever works for your personality.
Mm-hmm. Now, with the margin of safety question, I do agree that the net nets are gone. The cigar butts are gone, unless you're looking in very remote frontier markets. I think there's still pockets of inefficiencies there. But those, again, you have to admit, those are highly illiquid markets, very few participants, and it's very hard to trade. So I think.
And then number four, but who's finding them? So this is what you do for a living, right? Like, this is what you do all day, every day. This is your passion. This is your livelihood. I'm talking to the average person who thinks that they could go onto Yahoo, look at a few ratios, and think that there's like some safety there. Oh, this thing is yielding 8.5%. And what does that mean? So I don't think that the average person can be a successful value investor.
Yeah. So it's so basically what you're saying is like, it's almost like golf. Like, you can't expect to play once a weekend or a few times a month and be a PGA pro. Like, that's just not possible.
That's a great analogy. So if you're reading the statements, the SEC statements, and this is your world, can you have success finding undervalued companies? Of course you can. Of course you can. But I'm just saying, for the average person who is going to read security analysis, which is probably nobody at this point, and then think that they're going to be the next Warren Buffett, it's not going to happen. Those days are long gone.
Mm-hmm. And you know what's sad is, this is completely off topic, but how good Tiger Woods' son is at golf. Like, it's so frustrating. You see his swing, it's perfect.
I'm not a golfer, but I did see his swing, and yeah, that was pretty impressive.
I mean, just watching the two of them play golf was awesome. There was a photo of like Tiger's son in a red shirt on Sunday. Then Tiger was standing over him. I'm like, man, that's a nice way to end 2020. All right, let's move on now to closing questions. We're actually over an hour, so this is kind of flown by here. You are doing a lot, obviously. You've got a really successful presence on Twitter. You run a website, Irrelevant Investor. You also have a podcast, Animal Spirits. What has been the greatest lesson you've learned from kind of doing these projects, especially your podcast? Like, what have you learned from starting Animal Spirits that you wouldn't have otherwise known?
Yeah, so I definitely took this for granted, the fact that talking cohesively is difficult. And that might sound completely ridiculous, but getting thoughts out of your brain through your mouth and into the listener's ears is much harder than it sounds. And that took me a while to build that muscle. And it also has also taught me to have more empathy for people on TV or people that you hear speaking and you disagree with them and you write them off and you say, oh, what a fucking idiot. I can't believe you said that. Right? Like that's like a natural, maybe a violent, but a natural reaction to, you know, when you disagree with somebody. But I listen to my podcast every Wednesday when it comes out. And I disagree with myself all the time with something that I said 48 hours ago. And if you're talking on a wide range of subjects, I'm not an expert on everything. I'm an expert on basically nothing.
Yeah.
And so like, just because somebody says something, maybe like take it easy and give them the benefit of the doubt. Cause they might not even agree with what they said.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. It kind of goes back to this idea, like just watching people try to dunk on other people on Twitter for just simple investment ideas. Or like, it's like, I don't get why you would spend the time trying to dunk on somebody, unless it's like a fun, like joke about, you know, something that's lighthearted. But it's like, it doesn't matter if someone's investment process is different. Like if I'm long Open Door for XYZ, it's like, why would I spend time trying to dunk on somebody? I should try to learn why they're long and maybe see like, hey, you know, I've been bearish, but let's have a chat.
Well, I understand the mentality as somebody that has been dunked on and gets trolled from time to time. I understand where it's coming from. It's coming from people that are not especially happy, that aren't, you know, feeling too good about themselves, because if they were, they wouldn't spend time shitting on somebody else. So I'm not, you know, I get it. I understand that we're an easy target. I totally get it. But you're right. You never look good making somebody else look bad, right? Yeah. Especially if you're trying to build a name for yourself and a reputation for yourself, which is really all that we have, then don't be an asshole. I mean, it's simple advice, but there's people, and you know who they are, that misbehave. They just look like jerks. And why would you want to give money to that person, be associated with that person? So I think it's pretty easy advice to stick to. It's like, just don't be a dick.
There you go. I wish I could make that the title of the podcast, but we'd run into some issues there. Now, one question that I ask everybody, and I'm interested to get your thoughts on, if you could have dinner with one person from the past or the present, who would it be and why?
So I appreciate you getting these questions to me so I can not embarrass myself too much. When I saw this question, I was like, oh, come on, this is a ridiculous question. And so I was sort of angry that I was going to have to really think about this. But it came to me very quickly. Mark Twain.
Okay.
Because he was a horrific, horrific investor. One of the worst investors ever. Everything he touched turned to shit. And I would love to have a few drinks with him and hear him talk about some of the investments that he made.
Yeah. Like, didn't he buy at the top of the South Sea bubble or something, or the tulip bubble or something?
No,
like
that was before his time, but he invested in, he was like a venture capitalist or wannabe VC. And he kept investing these ridiculous ideas, these like an early typewriter that had like 50,000 moving parts. And he just kept sinking good money after bad. And he invested in a few gold and silver mines, and just, and some of the quotes that he had about losing his shirt were truly, epic.
I think it was Isaac Newton. Yeah, I don't know why I said freaking Celsius bubble, because that's in 1720.
That's okay.
So yeah, Isaac Newton, one of the greatest minds of all time, bought at the top in 1720 in the South Sea bubble. So this game's hard. This game's hard.
Yeah.
All right. Michael, go ahead.
No, I mean, that is, if I had to like just boil down like my entire philosophy, that would be it. It doesn't matter what you're doing. There is no easy way to make money in the stock market, even if you're just buying and holding. Nothing is easy.
Yeah. Yep. Couldn't agree more. I think that's a great place to end. So, Michael, where can people go to find you? Obviously, you're prolific on Twitter, but where are some other fishing holes people can spot?
I have a podcast that I do every Wednesday, Animal Spirits. That's probably a good place to start.
All right, cool. Sounds good. Michael Batnick, thanks so much for coming on the show. I really look forward to chatting with you again, and it was awesome to get to connect.
All right, Brandon. Thank you.